You are listening to Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are. We now present the Catechism Hour, hosted by Brother Justin Bunyan.
Welcome to the Catechism Hour with me, Brother Justin Bunyan, and we're going to continue off of last week's Our Lady of Good Counsel episode. We're going to look at the Albanian hero of Skanderbeg. So, Georges Cazerotti. His name, he was born on the 6th of May, 1405, and died the 17th of January, 1468. But he was known as Skanderbeg. I think Skanderbeg was the Ottoman Turkish name, form of his name. And he was the leader of this great rebellion against the Ottoman Empire in what was, what is today Albania, Northern Macedonia, Kosovo, Montenegro, and Serbia. So he was the lord of the Principality of Cazerotti. And he had his allegiances, if you might put it that way, to the Republic of Venice. And that would be like the overlord. And this area was invaded by the Turks. So it's kind of one of those pivotal points. But he has a funny, like, religious background. So, by upbringing, he was Orthodox. And then he was forcibly converted to Islam, a Janissary, as I had mentioned earlier, in 1423. And then he converted from Islam to Catholicism in 1443. So it's kind of a full spectrum. So, let's go through his story. And we'll see why he is considered such a hero in the lure of the Balkans. So he was a member of the ruling family of Cazerotti, and he was taken as a Janissary hostage. And there he was educated and forcibly entered into the service of the Ottoman Sultan for the next 20 years. That would be the period where he was Muslim. There he rose to the ranks. He got to the point of an appointment as a sacerbey, or a governor, in 1440. In 1443, he deserted the Ottomans during the Battle of Nice and became the ruler, in that region. In 1444, he was appointed as chief commander of a short-lived League of Seher and consolidated the nobility throughout what would be called today Northern Albania. was the first time Albania had a united front with a single leader. The Skanderbeg Rebellion was not a general uprising of Albanians because he did not gain the support of the Venetian-controlled north or in the Ottoman-controlled south. His followers included part Albanians, also Slavs and Greeks. This victory and his rebellion became a point of myth because of his victories. Small bands defeating great armies. The resistance led by him brought Albanians of the different regions and dialects together under a common flag and cause, and helping themselves identify themselves as Albanians, not as subject people. The problem with Skanderbeg was that his military skills were a major obstacle for the Ottoman expansion, and he was considered by many as a model of Christian resistance in the East. For 25 years, from 1443 to 1468, Skanderbeg's 10,000-man army marched throughout Ottoman territory, winning consistently, larger and better supplied armies, and defeating those armies. And for that, even the Ottomans admired him. Skanderbeg would sign his declarations in Latin, Dominus Albani, Lord of Albania, and claimed no other titles but that in documents. In 1451, he was recognized de jure in the sovereignty of the Kingdom of Naples over Albania through the Treaty of Getia to ensure a protective alliance. In other words, he is desperately trying to get some of the bigger boys in the Italian peninsula to get involved in Albania and to help protect it against the Ottomans, who were rampaging. In 1460 and 61, he participated in the Italian Civil War in support of Ferdinand of Naples. In 1463, he became the chief commander of the crusading forces of Pius II, but the Pope died while the armies were still together and gathering. Together with the Venetians, he fought against the Ottomans during the Ottoman-Venetian War in 1663 to 1479, until his own death in January 1468. Where did his name come from? The original Latin form of his surname, Kasrotit, is rendered from a modern Albanian. And this was typical of a person of the land. The Ottoman Turks gave him the name Skanderbeg, meaning Lord Alexander or Leader Alexander, which was rendered into Skanderbeg in the English version of his biographies. In 1450, he signed it Skanderbeg. But his life became a myth. And it's interesting because they say that the spiritual descendant of Skanderbeg is Mother Teresa, which is fascinating. Mother Teresa bringing the faith to India and to evangelize the way she did was in the same way what Skanderbeg did in Albania. What's interesting about him is that not only was he an incredibly good military leader, but a leader of people. He moved alliances as needed to defend the purpose of his crusade. He was taken as hostage as a boy And he was put into the system. He was put into a system. He was forcibly converted. But he understood the Ottoman military machine from the inside out. And because of that, when he fought to keep Albania free, he knew how they would work. Skanderbeg was known for his ability to duel, to fight, and to win. So in early November 1443, Skanderbeg deserted the forces of Sultan Murad II while fighting against the crusaders of John Hunyadi. According to the earlier source, Skanderbeg deserted the force during the battle of Konavica. He quit the field along with 300 other Albanians serving in the Albanian army. And he was able to take over a city. And with that, he was able to cement his legacy. The flag that they flew, Skanderbeg flew, is similar to the flag that the Albanians use until today. So the Ottomans would refer to him as Han Eskandet, or Skanderbeg the Treacherous. He abandoned his Islam, he reverted to Christianity, and ordered all the others who embraced Islam or were Muslim colonists to convert to Christianity or face death. He found a way of gathering together the diverse peoples of the Balkans and put them in together in his army. He was Albanian. He brought Montenegrins. He brought in Serbians. He brought in all these different people together to make this Christian army. And with that, he made a name for himself throughout Europe. In Europe that had forgotten the faith, a Europe that had become more and more humanistic, Skanderbeg called back to a past that was willing to defend the faith. And in that sense, and in that development, he puts forward an army of 10 to 15,000 soldiers. Constantly working with other princes and other people in the area to gather them together. We can understand why he was so loved. And in the story of the Balkans, an area which celebrates their defeats to the Ottomans, we can understand why Skanderbeg shone as a hope in the future for them. This element of him being what he was only possible because of his very, very strong devotion to Our Lady. He would carry an icon of Our Lady of Good Counsel, Our Lady of Paradise, as it was called at that time, with him into battle. And he would invoke her constantly throughout his battles. She was his co-signer. He defended her shrine. So when he dies, we can understand why she ends up and Albania collapses without a strong leader. And when the internal forces turn towards on each other, that Our Lady leaves with a few faithful soldiers. His name went throughout Europe, from England to Scotland to the Norwegian countries. And when he died, it was considered a great defeat of Christendom. It was as though the wave that had taken down Constantinople and all the defeats that surrounded that defeat we're going to submerge all of Europe. We'll have the first of the turning of the wave at the failed siege of Vienna, and then the Battle of Lepanto. And then we have the siege of Malta, which after that point, the strength of the Ottoman Empire begins to crack, and it slowly drifts until it is dissected at the Congress of Vienna, the Congress of Versailles, the Second World, First World War. But we see the remnants of that, of those policies of the Ottomans in the war that happened in the early 1990s. In the war, the Bosnian-Herzegovina war between the Serbs and the Bosnians, the war between the Croats and the Serbs, a lot of that was caused when the Ottomans came in. The Ottomans had a very interesting system. They didn't have enough Turkish Muslim settlers to settle all the Balkans. So they began to do the following. They would go in and they would offer a cash payment for any family that would convert to Islam. Once they had converted, they would turn them into the local leader, the mayor of the town. And then the ones who refused would be forced to pay a poll tax, according to Sharia law. Over the generations, this naturally causes a differentiation in the population. You have the one people, the ones who had converted become richer, become better attached to the local political apparatus, and the Christians move down. So when we have nationalism in the 19th century, where they begin to break apart the countries from the Ottoman Empire, the memories of the ethnic issues, not really ethnic, it's actually just purely religious, because the people are all the same. They're all the same ethnicity. Are never forgotten. And with not being forgotten, this progresses. And under Marshal Tito, from the end of the Second World War to the fall of his Yugoslavia Republic, it basically explodes. Hundreds of years of animosities, of resentments, of tick for tacks, are basically a case of the biggest return of payment ever. And that's why people on the outside weren't able to understand what was the big difference. Ethnically speaking, they were all the same. The Bosnians and the Herzegovinans are Croats. They're Serbo-Croats, the same ethnicity, except they're Muslim. And with that, amongst them, they were others, and they should be exterminated. They were traitors. We don't understand, but this goes back hundreds of years, and this could go back to the time of Skanderbeg. Skanderbeg, a great devotee of Our Lady, dies. And with him dying, the dream of a resistance dies with him. The attempt of Skanderbeg to make deals with the unwieldy Venetians brings nothing. And finally, Skanderbeg is in a very difficult position. Though he's won so many battles, he's defended his people so many ways, he's betrayed by one Mosi Golemi, who ends up coming into the area with an army larger than Skanderborg's. A nephew of Skanderborg, a George Balasik, sells a fortress to the Ottomans. His treason is discovered. Skanderborg's nephew, who was hoping to be the successor at the birth of Skanderborg's son, defects to the Ottomans the same year as his son's born. And in the summer, an Ottoman army numbering more than 70,000 men invade Albania with the hope of destroying the Albanian resistance, paved on the back of traitors. This army was led by Asak Beg and Hamasad Kasurati, the commander who knew all about the Albanian tactics and strategy. Skanderborg attacked the forces of the encampment and defeated them, killing 15,000 Ottomans, capturing 15,000 and 24 standards and all the riches of the camp. This was one of the most famous of all of Skanderborg's victories, and it led to a 5-year peace with Sultan Mehmed II. Hamza was captured and sent for detention in Naples. In this scenario, we end up in a case of victory after victory after victory. And then Skanderborg trying to find a means to cement peace. And this peace doesn't come easily. Skanderborg falls ill with malaria and dies the 17th of January, 1468, aged 62. Until his end, he always held everyone together. The Ottomans send more and more men, traitors, betray him here and there. And that's why we end up in that situation with Our Lady and those faithful ones around her shrine saying there is no hope. Everyone promises assistance, and as normally happens in politics, none of it comes. The Albanian leaders flee to Naples, and this begins an Albanian exodus into southern Italy. So the story of Skanderborg is very interesting, but how it links to Our Lady is very interesting. It's as though Our Lady had given Albania a chance. If they had risen up as a whole with Skanderborg, who knows what would have happened. But remember the question of those three we were talking about in our last week's show. Let's put ourselves there and say, where would we have been? Taken by earthly ambition? Maybe. Who knows? But let's ask in a special way for Our Lady of Good Counsel to guide, protect, and to be with us as we continue. So, Skanderborg. I do recommend that you do look up his story. His story is fascinating. And with it, it's an interesting read. And if you have any Albanian friends, most of the time they'll be willing to add a few little details that are not as well known. They're part of the mythos of Skanderbeg and his amazing stories. At that time, there were several individuals who were great leaders in Eastern Europe who found ways of pulling up the people towards a great end. And in that, they allow us to look towards great leaders to follow. So we're going to end this part of Skanderbeg's story, and I'm going to transition it into the person who is one of the causes of Skanderbeg's defection, John Hunandi. John Hunandi is an interesting character. He's one of those Skanderbeg characters of the late 1400s, and we're going to follow his route because it's interesting how each one of these is connected. So when we come back from the break, we're going to crack that nut as we move forward. Be back in a quick moment's time. We'll be right back.
to the Catechism Hour. Here on Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are. To contact us, you can tweet us at Radio Maria Can or email catechismhour@radiomaria.ca.
Welcome back. So we're looking at John Hunyadi. John Hunyadi is an interesting individual. He's born in 1406. He dies in 1456. He was he died in the Kingdom of Hungary. At that time, the Kingdom of Hungary went all the way down to Serbia. So he died in what is now Zemun, or at that time it was Zemuni, now it's Zemun, Serbia. And he was buried in what is now Alba Iulia in Romania. He came from the house of Hunyadi. So what made him interesting was he was Hungarian, and he was a leading political figure of Central and Southern Europe during the 15th century. His family descended from a Romanian royal family, and he was... His military skills were sharpened and honed on the southern borderlands of the Kingdom of Hungary that were exposed to the Ottomans' attacks. He was appointed the head of Transylvania and the head of several southern counties. He assumed responsibility for the frontiers in 1441. Hunyadi adopted a Hussite method of using wagons for military purposes. He employed professional soldiers and also mobilized local peasantry against invaders. These innovations contributed to his earliest successes against the Ottomans, who were plundering the southern marches, the southern borderlands, in the early 1440s. Although defeated in the Battle of Varna and the Second Battle of Kosovo, his successful long campaign in the Balkan Mountains and his defense of Belgrade, the capital, present-day capital of Serbia, against the Sultan, who was personally leading his troops, gave him the great reputation as a wonderful general. The Pope ordered the European churches to ring their bells at noon to gather the faithful to prayer for those who were fighting. The bells of the Christian churches were rung at noon to commemorate the Belgrade victory. And that's one of the sources of where the tradition of singing, of praying the Angelus at noon. John was also an eminent statesman. He actively took part in different wars. He knew how to play his cards, you may say. And he was very popular amongst the lower nobility. He acted in a way which made him loved because he put himself on the front line. Pope Pius II, don't forget, he was the one who was a supporter of our last friend, called him Atleta Christi, Christ champion, and died, unfortunately, 3 weeks after Belgrade. His victories over the Turks prevented the invading of Hungary for more than 60 years. His fame was a decisive factor in the election of his son, Matthias Corvinus, as the king by the Diet of 1457. Hunyadi is a popular figure, very similar to our Skanderbeg. Both are very similar in that way, amongst Hungarians, Romanians, Serbians, Bulgarians. As in the southern part, it would be Skanderbeg. But both are very similar. The family itself is a noble family, but it's a family of giving of self. It's a military family. Again, we're talking about an era in which it seems that the nobility has given itself over to what is pleasure, what is great, what is dancing, what is whatever. And there is becoming less and less of the debt which the military have in the military side, to fight and to defend the people. This family is still according to the old school. And this is always a change in an era, which you have one era of people who do a certain thing and it works. And the younger generation kind of looks at it and goes, I'm not interested. I want an easier way. And this, unfortunately, will come around during the reign of his son, Matthias, and then later the crushing of Hungary, and then the Ottomans running it up until the siege of Vienna. Though his family was of Hungarian extraction, he marries Romanian extraction. He marries a Hungarian princess, and that gives him bona fides in the kingdom of Hungary as truly a son of Hungary. But his crusades against the Ottomans begin in 1438. Because the Ottomans had occupied at this point a large part of Serbia. And the same year, the Ottoman troops had made incursions into Transylvania. They had made incursions into Romania. So they're beginning to take over that part, and he's able to push them back. It'll be his example which gives Skanderbeg the opportunity and the push to defect and to begin his own Albanian rebellion. So it's interesting in this point is to look at an individual through his own personal courage and heroic actions can help others on their journey. This is what's important. We act as guides. Many of us act as, through our baptismal promises, we have a triple vocation. We're called to be priest, prophet, and king. And sometimes those are exhibited through many different ways. And in those ways, it gives us the ability to bring Christ, bring our Lord's presence to others who are distant. In the part of Skanderbeg sees John, and he sees in John something which can be emulated. Pius II, who will be a great friend of both men, will refer to John as the Christ champion. And Skanderbeg will be, in a sense, a mama's boy. He is a great devotee of Our Lady. So where does that put us? John, in his battles, does he win all of them? No. But he gives himself and those people an opportunity to react. He gives them an example. And with the examples, they have the choice. Over it, we have the question of free will. We can choose good and we can choose evil. We can choose Christ or we cannot choose Christ. We can choose the difficult, rocky road. But where does that slice and put ourselves sometimes? Sometimes that might be difficult. Christ didn't say the way to heaven is the easiest route. John dedicates himself to a long life of military campaigns and battles and risk. The cross of Christ is for all other Christians also. Christ takes his cross first and carries it to Calvary and endures everything. All of us are called to the same calling, but it's up to us. The issue in all of these stories is a yes that we make. We look at the story of Skanderborg. Skanderborg makes an advance, makes another advance. Things look like they're being consolidated, and someone becomes envious. Someone becomes jealous. Someone is backstabbing. And what happens with that? Well, treason. And the death of thousands of his own people. That last battle shows it to you very well. Shows you what happened. They make this massive attack, and Skanderborg's able to defeat them. Take Hansa as a traitor and put him into jail. What type of battle would it have been if Hansa had fought those evil inclinations of jealousy and envy, and instead had fought alongside his uncle, and instead of becoming so envious, had taken that secondary spot? Maybe he would have been the victor. Maybe he would have been the glorious captain. Maybe he would have been known in history as something to be acclaimed and glorious, instead of someone who dies rotting in a prison. The crusade of the long campaign is the one that Skanderborg turns. He gathers 800 of his Albanians and they go home. And then they begin the rebellion. But think about it. Hunyad, he puts himself out there. He puts money from his own treasury to get mercenaries, to get troops, to gather people. If he hadn't have done it, Skanderborg never would have turned. So we need to see things in that perspective. How would we like to die? How would we like to be remembered? An athlete of God, Athletes Christi, God's champion, or to die in prison. The symbols of the Renaissance, humanism, will take away the spirit of resistance, because if it's all based on this earth and there is no heaven, then why should I sacrifice myself? It makes no sense. The Great Rebellion, if it had been better supported, would have allowed the Christian peoples who had been under subjection, under the Sharia law, under the poll taxes, what have you, under the dizma, they would have revolted. But one man stands up and one man can't do it all. So, where do we place ourselves in history? This is what makes history interesting. Because in history, we see the yeses and we see the noes. We see the possibilities that are always present. But also we see when people say no. And when people say no, it's a tragic situation. Very tragic. How many good popes during that era of the Renaissance and the late Middle Ages, cried over the defections of Christian kings who had armies, and instead of turning their armies against the enemies that were abroad, they fought petty battles, petty wars with other Christian kings over morsels of land that didn't need to be fought over. There was no greater need. Where does it put us? It's interesting for us, because when we read the stories, it's very nice to kind of look at it saying, well, it was nice for them. But when we can look at it with ourselves and say, what would I do if I was in the same situation? If I had the opportunity, would I be any different? Because that's it. That's the story. That's the key. If we see things in that manner, then in truth we can move forward. But it's up to us. It is always up to us. And that is where it gets difficult. I remember I was teaching a class, and in the class, one of the children put her hand up and said, "But if I was there," and I said, "Well, there was a famous conversion of a famous barbarian, Frank, name was Clovis. And Clovis decided to convert, and he was being catechized. And when he heard about what happened to Jesus Christ on the cross and how the passion happened, how Judas had betrayed him, he took the pole in his hand and smashed it on the ground. And he said, 'If I and my Franks were there, this would never have happened.'" And he swore that it would never happen with his Franks. And his descendant led crusades to try to liberate the Holy Land. His descendants would be Richard the Lionheart, would be Louis the Ninth, and many others. Many a soldier, his descendants. So what do we say? How do we place ourselves? Where do I go? If we were there, would it be different? Or would we be tempted by offers? Like the Man for All Seasons, Thomas speaking with Richard Rich, who he's already, with a good lawyerly eye, has already discerned that it's a weak individual, slimy individual, who doesn't have much moral backbone. And he says, "You know, I'm going to find you a job which you'll earn well. You will be able to exhibit your intelligence, but away from the temptations of this world." And Rich doesn't like that proposition. He wants to be in the middle of it all. And he goes, "But Rich, you're offered all types of things, bribes, manor houses, coats of arms." He goes, "Yes, I want those things." And he goes, "Go where you won't be tempted." Sometimes we think we are greater than these individuals in history, and we think that we can do better. And in reality, we don't do any better. We fall in the same sins that our forefathers fell into. We're no stronger. But with God's grace, with intercession of Our Lady, with our many saints, many protectors in heaven, we hope to do better than they did in the past. And if we fall, we recourse to the throne of grace, asking for help, assistance in the many struggles that befall us. But it's important for us to step forward. It's important for us to be different. It's important for us to see the weaknesses within ourselves, but also to see, if we correspond to God's grace, that we can make a difference. We can make a difference each day, but only if we have that confidence that God can work through us, and if we give ourselves over to Christ. Or if we do not, well, can't get to heaven by ourselves. We can't perform virtue by ourselves. And without God in our lives, it's going to be very difficult to do anything good. So let's ask in a special way for all of those graces we need, all of those graces that we should be asking for on a regular basis, but we don't, because we are proud, because we are like these men who got in the way of these two great heroes, tied down to other things. Other things get in the way. So let's ask in a special way to Our Lady of Good Counsel of Genazzano to protect us and to bring us once more to her home in paradise. Amen. May God bless you.
Been listening to the Catechism Hour, hosted by Brother Justin Bonnion, here on Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are.